it's a page turner, you know, you keep going. The stories, the personal stories are so...
It's a page turner because the people are interesting.
Yes. So thank you for your time.
I'm Richard Reeves, and the book is called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment During World War II.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was fun. Interesting.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 1:59. Coming up next, Lit Fantastic host Neil Aitken talks to writers Lee Herrick and Lynn Maitani about their personal obsessions and how it finds its way into their works. At 3, KBOO DJ Sun Lee takes to the airwaves with his special APA Heritage Day playlist. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
This is The Lit Fantastic, a podcast series about authors and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Aitken. In this episode, I speak with Lee Herrick, a good friend of mine who happens to be the former poet laureate for Fresno City, California, and the author of two books of poetry, Guardian Secrets of the Dead and This Many Miles from Desire. We talk about his obsession with institutions. One of the things I like about this particular episode is how a discussion about institutions and Lee's interest and obsession with them becomes a larger discussion about our humanity and the way that some of these institutions can dehumanize us, while at the same time we can have opportunities to restore humanity and rebuild community through the positions we have within an institution. So let's drop into the conversation at the point when Lee is sharing with me his experience as a poet laureate. One of the things that he did during his tenure as a poet laureate was to give poetry readings and workshops at correctional institutions. At this particular point in the conversation, he's explained his first visit to a level 2 correctional facility and the impact it ended up having on him in reconsidering the role of institutions and their place in humanizing and dehumanizing our experience.
One of the current things I'm thinking about obsession-wise, I don't know if it's an obsession or not, but I am thinking about it a lot with poetry and public space, is the idea of institutions. And it was really sparked recently. About a month ago, I did a reading and a talk at a California state prison, which is a level 2 facility here. It was extremely eye-opening. You know, for me, it was a way to make what I have always believed in, which is redemption or human rights or questions about the institutionalized racism that might produce different numbers in institutions like that. It was a way to make all of that very real, you know? I think you can read 20 books of theory on any given subject, but spending 1 hour in it is perhaps more valuable, or at least as valuable. So it was a real eye-opener, and really it was one of the best reading experiences of my life. The Q&A was one of the best Q&As I've ever been part of. With institutions, I'm thinking about now most recently because of that visit, but also, you know, having taught in higher education, the institution of academia, the institution of higher education in America for 25 years, and seeing how those policies and practices and open doors and closed doors and at different levels affect people in our communities. And then going all the way back to my birth, you know, I was born in Daejeon, South Korea, and I don't know exactly how long, but I spent probably the first roughly, you know, 10 months of my life in some form of institution, be it a social welfare center or an orphanage. So it's just recently sort of started to be in the forefront of my thinking and my mind. It's an extension, I think, from my third manuscript I just finished, which has to do with other kinds of sound and other kinds of walls and how we think and how we move and how we experience the world.
You spoke about speaking and giving this reading and this Q&A at the at this correctional institution. And I was wondering, what were some of the questions that you received? You talk about it as being probably the most memorable and striking and sort of an incredible experience. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on some of the questions and some of the responses that you heard while you were there.
Sure. The Q&A was, I think it was so good, partly because of the range of experiences that they had come with, but also just the context of it being in a prison. You know, I'm very interested in ideas of liberation and experience and confinement and how all those things sort of merge together. So, you know, they just were very real. I think there's very little time or interest, I might guess, for pretense. And I value that. I appreciate that. I'm not ever all that fascinated with or impressed by airs or those kinds of things. So I think that's one thing that made it particularly refreshing, is just how straightforward and direct and honest the questions were. For example, they asked me questions about personal fears. They asked me questions really about their own writing, which, you know, included a few of the guys who had started a writing group in the prison. One person had a bachelor's degree in psychology. One person had published a book. One of the men, quite a few of the men were in their, maybe I would guess, in their early 20s, and many of them were probably in their mid-70s. So it made for a great environment for a Q&A. And I think partly too is, as much as I love academia, you know, I teach in an MFA program. I love the MFA program that I teach in. Of course, I value education and would encourage it highly. For me, poetry has never been only about that. I've always been interested in people and cultures and writers and experiences that are very outside of any mainstream. And so that Q&A was that sort of thing. It was, at least for me, it was something that I had never experienced. And I think that's one of the things about obsessions in general. It can just become this wide open field that you can continually move into. It's sort of, you know, continual, these long hallways of open doors and fields and, you know, space to keep exploring. So, it was a great experience. I haven't really thought about it a lot out loud like this, so I appreciate, I hope I'm not, you know, rambling too much. Maybe I should have said my obsession is rambling. But I appreciate the chance.
This is one of the interesting things about obsession, isn't it? Is that we start off, and often we assume that an obsession becomes a narrowing of focus on something, an obsession with detail. But paradoxically, it also opens up, it widens a field. Then suddenly, everywhere we go, we see aspects that relate to the thing that we are, you know, fascinated with, the thing that we dwell on in our heads, in our minds, becomes ever present. It's all over the place, and it spills over into the other aspects of the things that we're doing.
You know, with institutions and whatnot, another obsession, and my wife knows this, and a couple of my good friends know, I have another real obsession, and that is 1960s political history and presidential history, and specifically John F. Kennedy. And that kind of relates to the idea of institutions as well.
So what's particularly fascinating? What's particularly fascinating about that particular period?
Oh, I just love it. I mean, I'm trying to contain myself here because I know this is going to be for a program, so I don't want to go on.
It's the whole point of the program.
Okay, well, let me tell you. I guess it really began in college when, in graduate school, I did my master's thesis on John F. Kennedy's crisis rhetoric, and I paired it with Aristotle's landmark work about 2,400 years ago, The Art of Rhetoric. But I looked at John F. Kennedy's crisis speeches, specifically the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then through that, afterwards, I got really interested in his assassination. And one winter, I was probably in my early to mid-20s, which was about 20 years ago, I bought these VHS tapes of other video footage of his assassination. Many people think that the Zapruder film is the only video footage of John F. Kennedy's assassination, but in fact, there are quite a few others. So I ordered this videotape, and I was watching these grainy documentary, you know, 30-second things of the assassination. You could barely make out anything on the video. It's all, since then, it's become a real interest. I've read probably dozens of books on it. I have a first edition hard copy of the Warren Commission report, which I found at some used bookstores, perfect condition. I was going to say they could have had it filed under fiction, jokingly, but you ask why or what is it about it that interests me. The political element, the element of truth, and the space and the open sort of questions and the intrigue and all of that. I've always been interested in how governments tell us things or sell us things. And so for me, that part of American history is a sort of a quintessential example of all of those things. So yeah, I, you know, it comes and goes. I don't spend much time on a day-to-day or even month-to-month basis thinking about it, but over the last number of years, it's definitely been a fun obsession.
I guess, you know, maybe part of the attraction is it is this historical event that's well documented. You know, it was actually televised, you know, as it happened, and yet it is still so full of mystery and uncertainty about what actually happened. There's a part of us that wants to believe that the things we encounter in our life are solid, clearly discernible. You know, we can clearly identify and demark, you know, what this event or this instant or this emotion or this thing is, when in fact, the more we look at it, the less certain we are we understand anything.
Yeah. You know, Plato said, true wisdom is knowing that you do not know. And for me, it's a good reminder, because if I had to think about what is it in me or my life that makes something like that question of his assassination so interesting, I mean, as a Korean adoptee, I don't have a lot of facts of my birth. I don't know exactly when I was born. My Korean name is Lee Kwang Soo, but I don't know that that was given to me by either one of my birth or first parents. That could have been just listed by the cop who found me and, you know, started the paperwork. So I think questions of the unknown, I think, are interesting to me now that I think about it. And honestly, and I have no idea, but I think all artists have this in some form, you know, that pursuit of some question or the fueling of some fire that can sustain the artist over a career, not in the career sense, but because they're fueling the art or the fire or the question. I don't know if you're into any of that. I know some of your obsessions. Part of me wants to interview you here, though.
Oh, Phil, ask away.
I don't know. Do you think of anything related to what I'm talking about or any other obsessions that you're...
Well, I do have like this kind of... I have so many obsessions. It kind of... Everything spills over. But, I mean... I'm not necessarily interested in JFK assassination, but I am fascinated with sort of like mysterious places, you know, archaeological sites of antiquity and sophistication that we can't quite completely explain or how different things work. I don't subscribe to ancient aliens as being the answer to everything, or even anything, but I love sort of reading about these places that we just simply don't understand because it doesn't fit our current model for history. Mm-hmm. And that sort of unease about, well, what is there? You know, what is it that we're missing? You know, mm-hmm. is really kind of compelling to me, because I think that, you know, that suggests that whatever we've arrived at as a consensus may not always be an accurate depiction of the world that we live in and the history that brought us here. Kind of feel like that maybe is the underlying obsession that runs through all the things we've been talking about. It's this really deep fascination, interest in what is the truth, given the fact that, you know, when we're in the context of, you know, a prison or a correctional institution, there is always the question of, like, well, what really did happen? How did these people really get here? What was the real story? Then there's also, you know, the question of, you know, what is the truth about, like, we look at sort of the different horrible things that have been happening over the last, well, I can't say the last few weeks. It's just been ongoing in the United States. And again, despite documentation, despite, you know, video footage or audio recordings, we're still left with this great unease about what is the actual truth in a situation.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what it is that we're, what the story is that we're trying to tell, whether through prose or through poetry. Enjoy what you're hearing? Obsessed with what you're hearing? Subscribe to The Lit Fantastic on iTunes. While you're there, leave us a review. Tell us what you think. And now, back to our interview.
I guess a third obsession is institutions is one, and JFK's assassination is another one. A pretty long-standing one has been the idea of racism and social justice, or racism in America as it applies to criminal justice, which might be an oxymoron. I don't know. But somebody said to me recently that it feels very urgent now, and I would agree. But one could argue that it has been an urgency of 400 years in America.
Yeah,
with periods of malaise or amnesia in between, you know. But my entry point into it when I was in college at about age 22 was watching Rodney King get beaten by the four police officers in California. I don't even think people had mobile phones back then in large numbers, but somebody videotaped this beating, and you know, it was on one of those big cameras you had to have probably on your shoulder, and it was really one of the first times that it had been captured on video, what people had been saying for decades. And that was a real eye-opener for me. That was caught on video, and those four cops were acquitted of excessive force, but they beat Rodney King for about 90 seconds, a minute and a half. So I've never felt and still do not feel that cameras, while they should and while they often ought to, that's one small part in a sea of a judicial process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think systemically it's so flawed throughout that to think one part of it will prove anything is short-sighted. In other words, just looking at the numbers of who's doing the policing and who are they policing, where and why. But, you know, before the stop is even made, you know, what are the tacit things of a policing department, which is a government branch, you know? And even I think about the public's perceptions of these people in different communities that are at the ready to acquit or sentence to guilt before any video is even shown. I think the video often doesn't mean anything to anybody. And in a court of law, you know, and then you look at a jury system, you know, you look at the makeup of juries or legal representation, or you look at the economic situation where a person can or maybe cannot afford a halfway decent attorney. Then you look at the judges, the appellate courts. I mean, so to say things are a little out of whack, I think is a great understatement. So, yeah, it's very disturbing. I hope and pray and will continue to work in my classes and in the areas that I can to work against these sorts of deaths, but unbelievably disturbing. You know, it's not new to say that this is not new, but I'm cautiously optimistic. At the same time, I am realistic and not so optimistic as far as America's ability to get it together. But yeah, the social justice stuff, and also with Asian American communities. You know, when I was in late college, I became familiar with the Wen Ho Lee case, and I got involved with that. He was the Taiwanese physicist who was held in solitary confinement for over 300 days, never having been charged with the crime. And I met Cecilia Chang, who was a family friend, who was sort of became the head of his National Legal Defense Fund. And that was sort of around the fear-driven hysteria that Asian Americans, specifically Chinese or Taiwanese Americans, were somehow connected, or Koreans, honestly, somehow connected to nuclear war, always and at the ready, and should be feared. So the Wen Ho Lee case was very formative for me as well. And of course, cases like Vincent Chin and more recent cases. So there's all kinds of things that I guess I obsess about, or a better way for me to think of it is that concern me, that worry me, that I'm hopeful for.
With so many, I mean, there has been so much, and there continues to be things that we are concerned with, and we want to do more to change and to affect a change in the communities that we live in and the society that we live in. A lot of the institutions we've talked about, you know, some of them contribute to the problem. Are there institutions or organizations or community movements that you feel are providing hope?
Love the idea that, and I believe in the idea that the arts are the thing. I mean, they're called the humanities for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's hope. I think, though, you know, the other thing I think of, though, is that given how, or given where we are in history, and the, you know, the institutions aren't going away.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there's got to be some middle ground between, you know, all out oligarchy and machinery driven, no human contact, and then the other extreme of everybody holding hands and getting along, and which might be, you know, I don't think that's going to fully happen anywhere either, but some middle ground where some of these humane ideas can enter the institutions. For example, gun violence. I mean, just some, you know, some sensible things to where it's not so much about power or policy, but more about just some agreed upon semblance of definition of decency. You know, and then this gets back, you know, you're talking about meeting people and talking and writing. You know, we were talking earlier, I'm going to go down and I'm doing that hour and a half of just a community hour as Poet Laureate, where hopefully I'll meet some people and they can tell me about what they're thinking about poetry or the community. You know, yesterday I had about a 2.5 hour coffee with a high school teacher here in Fresno, and we got to talking about some community things that we can do here in Fresno around writing, creative writing, and literacy and social justice. So there are a lot of things we can do. I joke with my students, or I've joked with my students before, and I say I'm not going down without a fight. Meaning I'm not going down not caring. I'm not going down being scared of other people because of the color of their skin. But those are the things I think that some of those institutions would have us believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is true. It's very hard to change sort of a culture that's grown up within an institution.
Yeah.
And especially when the institutions sometimes and often dehumanize the people that they're serving, treat them as commodities, or treat them as clients and customers. And we forget. We forget the life of the individual and the struggles of the individual and the needs of the individuals that we're trying
to serve. I mean, I think of the dehumanizing element of the prison system, or the dehumanizing element of, say, robotic, mechanical, certain kinds of work, or even a government structure's government's idea of work, or certainly something like media or the television that, you know, of course, creates this vast human experience into this tiny little example that we're all supposed to think is representative of the whole. So, yeah, and thank goodness there are books and shows with people people like you, you know, or museums or parks or lakes. Those are legislated to some extent. I mean, optimistically, you could say that the government tries to preserve some of those spaces, but those are still out there, you know. So my interest with institutions is as much an interest in open space and liberation, really. It's the same idea for me. Is always fighting against the things that will close me off in my thinking or in my idea of movement, or not just my own, but in how I see others. And I think that's part of what has been going on a lot, is how people see others in a very restricted, limited, negative way, which, you know, some people have said is a form of violence. You know, I remember Gloria Anzaldúa in Borderlands asked, what is more violent than robbing the people of its language? So, you know, if we expand our ideas of violence, it can be, for me at least, it's been a liberating thing.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And I've really enjoyed this conversation, but I'm watching the clock and thinking we've got to wind down.
Thank you, Neil.
I've really enjoyed this. Before you go, do you have one or two poems you'd like to share with us?
Well, how about I read a short one?
Okay.
This is a poem from my third manuscript that I've just finished. And it's a short poem. I don't think I need to explain too much of it, except to say that it's a short poem after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown. And I was at my daughter's school. At that time, my daughter was in first grade, the same age as the 20 kids who were tragically, their lives ended that day. So the poem is called What I Hear After the Massacre and What I Mistake for My Heart. Invisible birds shocked out of the trees, and you mistake them for children on the playground, or you mistake the leaves cracked underfoot for the children's hush or broken glass. It's a maelstrom. At the winter program, the second graders sing, "Let It Snow," and the parents clasp their hands, half exhale, half prayer. The children sing in your town, and you think of the children in the shattered town. All that comes to you is their hearts, heaven and hell, and the next kind word you will say to a boy.
Thank you. That's haunting.
My pleasure. You know, thank you for having me, and good luck with all the good work you're doing. I appreciate it.
That was Fresno Poet Laureate Emeritus Lee Herrick, the author of Gardening Secrets of the Dead and This Many Miles from Desire. For more information, you can check out his website at leeherrick.com. You've been listening to The Lit Fantastic, a production of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Special thanks to freemusicarchive.org and to our producer and resident genius, Jenna Yokoyama. To find out more, check out our website at www.thelitfantastic.com. Until next episode, I'm your host, Neil Aiken. Thanks for listening.
You're tuned in to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, KBOO's interim AM News and Public Affairs Director. The month of May is Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Month. So to recognize the month, KBOO is featuring programming from our Asian and Pacific Islander American identified programmers from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. today. Right now, you're listening to a couple episodes from KBOO's podcast, The Lit Fantastic. The Lit Fantastic is hosted by author and poet Neil Aiken. Neil has been a KBOO volunteer for the last couple years, and he's quite a force in the Portland literary arts scene. He's known for his Decanon Project at Milepost 5 in East Portland. Let's get back to our Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Day programming. Again, here's The Lit Fantastic with Neil Aiken.
This is the Lit Fantastic, a podcast series about authors and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Akin. In this episode, I speak with Valin Mayatani, the author of Ink and Ashes, the winner of the 2013 New Visions Award, and an old friend of mine from back in my undergraduate days. I've known Valin for years, literally for decades, and I had no idea she had this particular obsession.
I think it started maybe probably close to 10 years ago, maybe longer. But one of my strangest obsessions is with gaudy, ugly rings. And the bigger, the better. And at first, I don't even remember why I started it. I think I must have been in Las Vegas. But just the uglier, the better, and the bigger, the better. And one of the reasons I love it so much is that when I see these rings on other people, I always wonder what story is behind it. Sometimes I've seen rings that have huge fish and flowers and all kinds of things, and I just think, what made you pick that ring? And so it kind of gets my mind spinning, and I wonder what kind of things they're passionate about, and there's just so many stories I make up in my head about why a person would choose that kind of a ring. So everywhere I go, I'm always on the lookout for the ugliest rings possible. A lot of my friends know that I have a passion for these, so I often get them as presents. But the other thing I like about them is that they're so distinct that when I do buy one, I remember where I got it, and I remember why I got it, or I remember if it was a present from someone who knew that I liked these kinds of rings. And I just kind of rotate through my collection and wear them whenever I feel like wearing them. The other thing I like about it is that they're so awful that whenever I am wearing one, people are always going to ask about it. Where did you get that? Why did you get that? So I think it's a great conversation piece, and I love talking to people. I love meeting new people, and it's just been one of the fun things that is not something I would normally wear, but I just love it. It's something that I just love doing.
Okay, so what would you say is perhaps the weirdest looking ring that you've picked up over this time?
There are two different rings. One has a huge fake diamond in the middle, but then all around it are these little ceramic bees and flowers, and it's just this huge mess on top of a ring, and I absolutely love it. And then the other one is a combination of it's kind of hard to describe, but basically it's a huge fish that kind of wraps around in a circle so that the head meets the tail. But the fish is not pretty by any means. It's just big. It's just big orange, reddish orange fish. And I love that one too.
These sound amazing.
Yes. I mean, and how can you not look at something like that and think, I have to ask that person where she got that or why? I always get asked questions when I'm wearing these huge, ugly things, but it's fun.
So what's next for you? Do you have your eye on a ring right now? Something that you want to pick up that you've been hunting for, that you've seen?
No, I'm never on the lookout. What I do is it's just kind of this organic thing that if I happen to be somewhere and I see something that catches my attention, then I will get it. And I love when that happens, because that in particular, depending on where I am, that will always remind me of that place or certain memories. And it is unique. It's not, I think that people have snow globe collections or, you know, all kinds of collections from various places. But I like that. I don't think I've ever met anyone who has an ugly ring collection the way I do.
Maybe you're aspiring to Imelda Marcos level with her shoes.
Yeah, I can always try.
Yeah, we can all hope at some point too.
Yes. I think that would be the pinnacle of my career, reaching Imelda Marcos status. But you know, I may never get there.
So does this spill over in any way in terms of your writing or writing practice?
I think that the things, of course, that make characters memorable are these really unique things about them. And so I kind of use it as my metaphor for when I'm creating a character, finding these really unique things that make them stand out and mm-hmm. make it so that when a reader looks at this character and they see these unique kind of strange things, those unique things help them create a better picture and memory of that character. And I think that when we do that as writers, it allows the reader to connect on a different level, connect on a more emotional level. You know, whether you are into whatever this character is into, or even if you can't necessarily on a personal level relate to what makes that character unique, it's something that can connect readers to these characters just because they're different. And it helps, I think, in general, for people to read about characters who aren't like them. And I think that helps breed empathy in society in general, but just understanding what makes a person tick, what makes a person have that kind of perspective or think that the way that they do, because I think there's so many things that make people unique, and that is the thing that often, especially for young adults, which is what I write for, I think that there's a lot of focus on trying to be the same mm-hmm. and trying to be like everyone else, and we think that's what is going to make us happy rather than embracing the things that make us unique. And so I think I grew up in Utah. I am Japanese American, and there's not a lot of diversity. And so when I grew up, I remember I was fortunate in that I never was the recipient of racism or any kind of cruelty in terms of that. But I was very conscious of how I looked different from everyone else. So I remember as a teenager, especially feeling like I was like any other teenager, but every now and then wishing I had blonde hair and blue eyes so that I could look like everyone else and not be the one standing out in the crowd when someone walked into a room. And over time, and it's taken a lot of time, but over time I've realized that it's the unique parts of my personality that are the things that do make me stand out and that are worthy and are things that I should embrace rather than try to hide. And so I think that's part of why I love these big ugly rings, but also why those are the parts and characters that I really want to bring out and highlight so that other people don't have to look at, you know, the same thing all the time. They can see different aspects of characters and as I said, you know, come to understand different situations hopefully and different perspectives and therefore hopefully be more empathetic towards other people.
I love what you've done here. You've made this really interesting bridge between your collecting of these you know, quote unquote, ugly rings and sort of the experience of feeling outside or different, you know, whether it has to do with sort of racial or ethnic identity, physical appearance or other sort of markers that might separate us from the rest of the society. And I think what you're saying here, if I'm getting this right, is really that this is kind of a way of challenging sort of conventional beauty and saying that there's more than one way, that there's room for other things to be beautiful, and that you know, these rings are kind of emblematic of that sort of move towards saying, look, this is what makes them remarkable, is the fact that they don't adhere to the ways in which we expect things to look, and yet their full embrace of the way that they are different and challenging to what everyone else has kind of talked about as traditional or conventional beauty is actually what makes them really remarkable and appealing. It's not that they're hiding at all. They instead sort of celebrate this sort of almost avant-garde or very, not even avant-garde, just a different way of being beautiful. And I think it is, you're right, it really is sort of a message that is perfectly, you know, it fits within sort of that experience of growing up, and it definitely fits within a society such as our society, which is in the middle of these major shifts as, you know, more and more people come to the United States, more and more people, that diversity and multiculturalism, the effects of globalism as more and more people move throughout the country and throughout the world, we're going to just see a lot of different ways in which people can be beautiful and different ways in which we can, you know, deserve a place and be valuable.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and just, I think often in respect to the rings and in respect to the way I look in general, I think there's so many assumptions that people make right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there are assumptions that someone might make by looking at my ring and wondering, why is she wearing that? And I think there are certain assumptions that are made when someone looks at me and sees that I am Asian. And what I like is that a lot of times I am nothing like whatever assumptions these people have. And so I like that aspect as well, that first of all, I don't know. I think one assumption just from the get-go is that a Japanese American wouldn't necessarily wear a big, ugly, gaudy ring like I do, because, you know, I'm Asian. I'm supposed to be more conservative. I'm supposed to, you know, be quieter and then not necessarily. And so I love the idea that, you know, there might be these assumptions, but if you talk to me, you'll find that I'm probably not what you think I am. And I think that it's good to get to know people to figure out what they are, because I think everyone does it. I think I do it. You kind of make these judgments and assumptions just at first glance, and you may not always be right. And so I think it's good to open your mind a little and just give people a chance to see what they're really like.
Enjoy what you're hearing? Obsessed with what you're hearing? Subscribe to The Lit Fantastic on iTunes. While you're there, leave us a review. Tell us what you think. And now, back to our interview. So what would you say are some of the worst or strangest assumptions people make about writers in general, and maybe about your own experience as an author?
I think one big assumption that is just not true is that all writers make a lot of money, and we don't.
We insert the laugh track, right? Yeah.
Yes. There are some that definitely do, but the majority don't. And I think so. I definitely think that is one assumption. I think another assumption that I hear, and when I say assumptions about writers, I'm talking about people who are not writers making assumptions about people who are writers. I think there's an assumption that we have a lot of time to write and that it comes easy to us. And that is not true at all. I don't know how many people have told me, oh, I would love to write a book sometime, but I just don't have the time. And for me, if people knew half of what goes on in my life, they would realize they actually do have more time than I do. And so I think that they have this idea that, you know, I sit at home all day and I you can just call me whenever you want to do things because I don't really do anything all day. Yes, I work at home, but I work. And so I think that is another assumption. But I also think, as in related to what I just said, I think that people think that it comes easy for us, and it doesn't. Yeah, I don't think that people understand how hard writing is, and it's not just a natural talent. I hear a lot of times, you know, oh, he is such a talented writer, or she is such a talented writer. And I think that what people don't understand is that that talent was born out of like blood and sweat and tears and a lot of hard work. And even those who have, I guess, natural proclivities towards writing are still required to work very hard on their craft and work hard to make sure that they are up to par with, you know, their writing skills. It's not something that comes just so easily for people. So like anything that is worth doing, it is a lot of work.
Oh, I definitely agree on that. I think that that is sort of a recurring problem of when people see the end product, they don't see the process that it took to get there, and they don't see they don't see all the missteps and all the failures and all the places where things didn't go right and we had to start over. I actually one of the people I'm really fascinated by myself is a 19th century mathematician by the name of Charles Babbage. And he once wrote a book called On the Economy of Machines and Manufacturers, I think is what it was. But basically he did this study where he went through the entirety of England, visiting all the factories that made different things. And then he wrote a book kind of examining sort of the different processes that different factories and fields use to produce things, and looked at ways in which they might contribute to each other. But along the way, he made this comment that was absolutely, you know, it kind of speaks not just to the making of you know, manufactured goods, but writing in general. And he said that if you look over a room, that everything that you see is a history of failures.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that idea. I love the idea that everything that we see as a finished product is actually the sum of a history of failures, of things that we didn't get right until finally we did.
That is so true. That is so true. I've heard that on average, it takes a writer 10 years of solid writing before they are published. And that's a really long time. I think, you know, doctors go to school and work on that for 10 years before they become doctors. But I don't think anyone who is not a writer would naturally assume it would take someone 10 years. But there's a lot of work that goes into it, and there's a lot of failure. And there's a part of me, I mean, I don't know for sure, but there's a part of me that believes anyone can be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
If you work hard enough and you try hard enough and you're willing to fail over and over and over again, because there's so much failure in writing. There's so much not getting it right. And when I first started writing, I talked to this man named Rick Walton. He's written a million books, and he is so generous with his time and advice, and so knowledgeable about the industry. And so I was asking him for advice because it was brand new. And I said, what do you think I should, you know, like, what is the best advice you can give me? And his name is Rick Walton. And he said, I think you should quit. And I remember the sheer anxiety that started to just kind of buzz through me, because I was thinking, I thought I had finally figured out what I wanted to do with my life. I thought I'd finally figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up. I mean, yeah, it's taken many decades, but I thought I figured it out, and he's telling me to quit. And so I said, your advice is to quit? And he said, yeah, his writing's really hard. It's really hard. So my advice is to quit. And then he said, but if you can't quit, then write. And I love that, because I do think in life, not just writing, you know, you understand that it's worth it if, even if you wanted to, you couldn't quit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the ones that get published end up in that place, that even if they wanted to, they couldn't quit. And so despite how hard it is, despite the fact that not all of us are millionaires, it's something that we couldn't quit if we wanted to. And so I think those that just stay with it, are willing to fail, are willing to be open to feedback and constructive criticism, I think those are the ones who end up published.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. It is definitely not a sprint, but it's something that it's much more of a marathon, and it's not one marathon. It's just a continual series of marathons that we're running. And yeah, it would be easy to quit, except for the fact that you can't seem to quit. There are definitely times though when I feel like we take breaks and we separate ourselves from the work for a little bit. I think we have to do that for our own sanity, but we can never leave it completely alone. We have to come back at some point, do some more work.
Yeah, I think that with true writers, there's always that thing just kind of sitting at the back of your mind that even if you take a break for a few years, that thing all of a sudden starts to grow and until you have to write again.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Did you have anything you wanted to read for us today?
I can read the prologue of Ink and Ashes.
Okay.
Should I give the background of...
If you want to give a tiny little bit of context, yeah, that would be great.
Okay, so Ink and Ashes is a mystery / thriller. It's a young adult book that is about a Japanese-American teenage girl whose family is relocated to Utah, and her biological father has passed away. Her mom has remarried, and in the book, she ends up finding this letter that was written from her biological father to her stepfather, and she can't figure out why they would have kept it hidden from her. And as she digs deeper, she discovers that her biological father was a member of the Yakuza, which is the Japanese mafia, and so there was a reason why her parents had hidden that from her. And as she digs, she also unearths a bunch of problems. So this is the prologue from Ink and Ashes. People go to hell for what I'm about to do. The old man glares at me, his face so close I can see the wrinkles on his forehead stretch wide when he speaks. Do you know who I am? He yells. I choke on his stale, smoke-filled breath. A thick Japanese accent stains his words. Do you know who you are? Claire Takata, daughter of loving parents, devoted sister, loyal friend. He strikes me with the back of his hand, the force almost tipping the chair I'm tied to. The sting sends a burning shiver down the side of my face. Answer me, he demands. I am the heiress to a legacy I wish I'd never discovered. The cold night prickles my skin. I twist my hands, trying to escape, but the rope cuts into my wrists. I swallow hard and try again. All the terror he's put me through makes anger storm inside. I want to hurt this man as much as he has hurt me. If I were free, I could kill this man right now without guilt. That's it.
Wow. Tense. Now we have to read the rest of the story and discover what happens next.
Yep.
Yep, that's the goal, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Flynn, for being part of this conversation. And we are never going to look at strange and ugly-looking rings ever again the same way. It's going to be a new thing.
I hope not.
I agree. There's so many stories to be told. That was Valin Mayatani, YA author. Her debut novel, Ink and Ashes, was winner of the New Visions Award in 2013, as well as a number of other prizes. For more information about Valin and her upcoming projects, check her out online at valin.com. You've been listening to The Lit Fantastic, a production of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Special thanks to freemusicarchive.org and to our producer, Jenna Yokoyama. To find out more, check out our website at www.thelitfantastic.com. And until the next episode, I'm your host, Neil Akin. Thanks for listening.
You're tuned in to KABU Community Radio. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, KABU's interim AM News and Public Affairs Director. The month of May is Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Month. So to recognize the month, KABU is featuring programming from our Asian and Pacific Islander American Identified programmers from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. today. You know, one thing I really appreciate these days is the immersion of Asian American and Pacific Islander American music. Sure, the music is not exactly mainstream yet, but it's definitely starting to leave a mark. Here's one of my favorite Asian American bands out of Los Angeles, Run River North, with their recent ear candy, Rear View.
Wanna meet you in the rear view. We could see how we were before we changed. But when I look over, your hair is on the dashboard. Am I foolish to believe you're somewhere thinking of me? I wanted to hold you like I won't let go. You can't tie a rope around my soul. Tapping on the window, I can't be without you. So hold me like you won't let go. Like no one ever has to know. Tapping on the window. I know it's hard to believe, but I swear I'm broken too. Cause all I can hear are your lips, they say I'm sorry. Someone had to leave. I wanted to hold you like I won't let go. You can't tie a rope around my soul. Tapping on the window, I can't be without you. So
that was Rear View by the Los Angeles-based band Run River North. Curious to find out more about the Asian Pacific Islander American music scene? Are you just realizing that there's an Asian and Pacific Islander American music scene? Well, to learn more, I highly recommend the website tractivist.com. That's tractivist.com. Now, time for more Asian and Pacific Islander American programming here on your community radio station, KABU!
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Pete Sigard Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday. May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The 6th annual Pete Seeger Tribute is a family-friendly sing-along event that features Lauren Sheehan, Peter Hayes, Ben Davis, Bill Merlin, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Pete Seeger Tribute and 100th birthday celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peggy Dean's Guide to Nature Drawing and Watercolor Book Release Party on Sunday, May 5th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Tillamook Station in Portland. Artist, author, and art instructor Peggy Dean presents this nature drawing guide that teaches you drawing and watercolor techniques. The event also features food and treats, art supplies, a selfie station, and more. Again, that's Peggy Dean's Guide to Nature Drawing and Watercolor Book Release Party on Sunday, May 5th from 2 to 5 p.m. at Tillamook Station, 665 North Tillamook Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. And this KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Siren Nation. Presenting Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday, Saturday, May 4th at the Alberta Rose Theater. Featuring performances from Arietta Ward, Pacific Trio, The Cabin Project, Sarah Clark, and more. Minors welcome with a parent or guardian. Tickets and more information online at albertarosetheater.com. Well, thank you for tuning in today. My name is Sun Lee. I'm your host for the next hour, and I'm going to be playing music from the continent of